Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
People from two towns in the eastern state of Connecticut are arguing again about which is oldest. Connecticut, which was one of the British colonies, has a long history. The trouble started when experts discovered artifacts in the town of Wethersfield that are believed to date to the 1630s. The town says it was established in 1634. But a few miles up the Connecticut River is Windsor, which claims it was settled in 1633. The dispute has gone on for many years, with both towns claiming to be the oldest. There is even a dispute over the definition of a town. Settlers from Plymouth, Massachusetts, established a trading post in Windsor in the year 1633. Opponents say settlers from Watertown, Massachusetts, made Wethersfield their home in 1634. They say people in Windsor did not build homes until the following year. Brian Jones is an archaeologist for the state. He said, "I don't think it will ever be settled." Jones noted that the Dutch built a fort in Hartford in 1633 before the Windsor trading post, and there is some evidence of a trading post there from 10 years earlier. Recent evidence might throw some light on the dispute. Archaeologists working in Wethersfield say they have physical evidence of a settlement by people with European ancestors. They found a fence from the 17th century believed to have been used as a defense against Native Americans. They also found metal money and ceramics, beads used for trade, and other objects, including shells and animal bones. Sarah Sportman is an archaeologist with the group Public Archaeology Survey Team. She said the 17th century stuff was the most exciting because nobody knew it would be here. Some of the objects appear to date back to the 1630s. The non-profit group will save the objects for the public and write a report on them. The study began 2 years ago and ended in November. The discovery was made when work started on a visitor center for the Webb Dean Stevens Museum in the town. The museum includes the home of Joseph Webb. In 1781, George Washington and French General Comte Jean de Rochambeau met there to discuss battle plans during the Revolutionary War. The house of Silas Deane is also part of the museum. He served as a delegate to the First Continental Congress in 1774, and as a diplomat to France. Dean worked with Benjamin Franklin. The archaeological study was required by the state government to preserve any important artifacts found. That, however, does not change the mind of Windsor's supporters. Christine Ermance is the executive director of the Windsor Historical Society. We maintain that Windsor really is the earliest European settlement. They helped the Native Americans. They helped some of the traders going to Wethersfield, she said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
After closing its beloved toy store on Fifth Avenue, FAO Schwartz has returned to New York City. A new FAO store opened last Friday in world-famous Rockefeller Center. It is about 10 streets from its former home near Central Park. For more than 150 years, FAO Schwartz was known in New York for its high class and sometimes high-priced toys. The Fifth Avenue store opened in 1986, but financial problems at the parent company and rising rents forced that store to close in 2015. Now, FAO Schwartz is pulling back from the worst financial crisis since it was founded in 1862. In recent weeks, laborers worked 24 hours a day at 30 Rockefeller Plaza to get the new store ready. Workers filled the nearly 2,000 square meter space with hundreds of stuffed animals, bears, elephants, and more. The new store has the large clock that once occupied the entrance to the old store. And the building's second floor has a large piano keyboard. It looks just like the one on which Tom Hanks danced in the 1988 movie Big. By the way, copies of the more than 6-meter-long instrument sell for $128. There is also a toy food market where children can shop among plastic fruit. For $75, another interactive PlayStation shows children to care for baby dolls while a nurse explains how to hold them. A 9-meter-tall rocket is filled with stuffed bear astronauts. I'm Susan Shand.
Technology is forever changing the way we get our news. Many people now get a lot of their news on electronic devices, instead of traditional media such as newspapers, television, or radio. An increasing number of people also report turning to social media for information. Now, there is a new technology that could greatly change the way we get the news: computer-created news readers. Recently, China's state-supported news agency Xinhua launched what it called the world's first artificial intelligence, or AI, news presenters. Xinhua said it worked with the Chinese search engine Sogou to develop the AI presenters. The news readers, created by machine learning technology, are based on two real-life Chinese newsmen. One is able to present newscasts in English, the other in Mandarin Chinese. In Xinhua's report about the launch, it said machine learning was used to examine video images and sounds of the two newsmen. The system then created the AI robotic presenters, which look and sound like real people. Similar technology has been used to create video products known as deepfake videos. A deepfake is a video that looks real but was electronically changed. Such videos can make people appear to say things they never said or do things that never actually happened. Xinhua said the AI presenters will be a great improvement to the news team because they can work 24 hours a day on its website and on social media. One of the presenters even promised to work tirelessly to keep people informed. Xinhua claimed the AI newsmen were able to read the news as naturally as a human presenter. Some machine learning experts said the system showed off China's latest progress in voice recognition, text-to-speech technology, and data analysis. But several experts suggested that the term AI does not correctly describe abilities of the robotic news readers. On social media, many Chinese noted that the AI presenters did not seem real. People criticized them for not being more lifelike. On China's Twitter-like service Weibo, several users wrote that the news readers have no soul. One user joked, "What if we had an AI leader of China?" Others wondered about the effects robots might have on employment and workers. It all comes down to production costs, which will determine if we lose jobs, one Weibo user wrote. Some people argued that only low-level jobs requiring heavy labor will be easily replaced by robots. Others praised the technology as a way for companies to make money from low-cost labor machines. A writer for the MIT Technology Review declared Xinhua's newsreader announcement as fake news. China's news presenter isn't intelligent at all, the report said. MIT Technology Review said the presenter itself is little more than a digital puppet that reads. It added, "The AI in this case is the software that learns what makes a convincing-looking face and voice." While the demonstration was clearly evidence of improved technology, it was a very narrow example of machine learning, the report said. Some businesses have experimented with similar technology for possible use in news operations. Britain's BBC recently released a video that used machine learning to make it look like one of its newsreaders was speaking different languages. The London-based company that developed the system says its goal is to remove the language barrier for many different kinds of video across the internet. Also, developers working on Amazon's Alexa smart speaker system have worked to create a special newsreader voice for the electronic assistant. Trevor Wood works on text-to-speech technology for the Alexa system. He said in an internet post that a machine learning system was able to help Alexa learn to speak in a news-like voice after only a few hours of examining data. Such a system could be further developed to provide other kinds of speaking voices for different situations, Wood said. Amazon is reportedly preparing to launch Alexa's newsreader voice in the near future. I'm Brian Lynn.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The year was 1775. Colonists in Massachusetts had fought battles with British troops in the towns of Lexington and Concord. War had not been declared, but citizen soldiers in each of the 13 American colonies were ready to fight. Who was going to organize the colonists into an army? This was the first question that faced the Second Continental Congress when delegates met in May in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The delegates decided that the man for the job was George Washington. He had experience fighting in the French and Indian War. He seemed to know more than any other colonist about being a military commander. The delegates elected him as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He accepted the position, but said he would not take any money for leading the new army. George Washington left Philadelphia for Massachusetts, where he took command on July 3, 1775.
He was tall, he was very elegant, very well put together.
Jane Gorton at the Massachusetts Historical Society says Washington looked very impressive.
It's very interesting because when he came to take command of the Continental Army, many of the New England soldiers were not quite sure what to make of this man who was, after all, from Virginia, not from New England. Washington won them over. His conduct, his grace, I think his discipline was extremely important.
Back in Philadelphia, the delegates to the Second Continental Congress made one more attempt to prevent war with Great Britain. They sent another message to King George. They asked him to consider their problems and try to find a solution. The king would not even read the message. You might wonder, why would the delegates try to prevent war if the people were ready to fight? The answer is that most of the members of the Congress and most of the colonists were not yet ready to break away from England. They continued to believe they could have greater self-government and still be part of the British Empire. Jane Gorton at the Massachusetts Historical Society says many colonists felt conflicted and confused about their identity.
They're Englishmen, they're still Englishmen, but they're not Englishmen. All along, what they've wanted is just to have the rights of Englishmen, and it doesn't seem to be possible under an old system.
A major battle took place in June of 1775, just 2 days after the delegates in Philadelphia chose George Washington as commander. It was the first major battle of the American Revolution. It was called the Battle of Bunker Hill, although it really involved two hills, Bunker and Breeds. Both are just across the Charles River from the city of Boston. Massachusetts soldiers dug positions on Breeds Hill. The British started to attack from across the river. The Americans had very little gunpowder. They were forced to wait until the British had crossed the river and were almost on top of them before they fired their guns. Their commander reportedly told them not to fire on the British until they saw the whites of their eyes. The British climbed the hill. The Americans fired. A second group of British soldiers climbed the hill. The Americans fired again. The third time, the British reached the top, but the Americans were gone. They had left because they had no more gunpowder. Peter Drummy, a librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society, reads part of a letter that a young soldier wrote to his mother.
I was in the fort when the enemy came in, jumped over the wall, and ran half a mile, where balls, musket balls, flew like hailstones and cannon roared like thunder.
The British captured Breed's Hill, but Peter Drummy says the Americans still considered the battle a kind of victory.
The paradox is, even though the American forces are defeated and forced off the hill, nevertheless, the British casualties are so high that it is at least a moral victory.
Even the young American soldier who fled the battle wrote to his mother that he would continue fighting for American independence.
And in fact, that's probably what the British learned from this battle, that they could capture this hill at great cost, but the New England countryside is full of hills, and they couldn't capture them all back.
That battle also reduced whatever hope was left for a negotiated settlement. King George declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. The American colonists fought several battles against British troops in 1775. Yet the colonists were still not ready to declare war. Then, the following year, the British decided to use Hessian soldiers to fight against the colonists. Hessians were mostly German mercenaries who fought for anyone who paid them. The colonists feared these soldiers and hated the British for using them. In January of 1776, Thomas Paine published a document that strongly influenced the colonists. He named the pamphlet Common Sense. It attacked King George as well as the idea of a monarchy, a government led by a king or queen. The pamphlet called for independence. About 150,000 copies of Common Sense were sold in the colonies. Everyone talked about it. As a result, the Second Continental Congress began to act. It opened American ports to foreign shipping. It urged colonists to establish state governments and to write constitutions. On June 7, 1776, Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee proposed a resolution for independence. The resolution was not approved immediately. Declaring independence was an extremely serious step. Signing such a document would make the delegates traitors to Britain. They would be killed if captured by the British. The delegates wanted the world to understand what they were doing and why. So they appointed a committee to write a document giving the reasons for their actions. One member of this committee was Thomas Jefferson of Virginia.
He had already written a report criticizing the monarchy. So the other committee members asked him to write the new document. They said he was the best writer in the group. They were right. Jefferson was 33 years old. It took him 17 days to write the document. The Second Continental Congress approved it on July 4, 1776. It was America's Declaration of Independence. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University says the Declaration was a message to the world.
They are trying to, I think, signal to the world, we are a new nation, we've broken away from this other nation. We're a separate nation, and we want recognition of our independence.
The Declaration of Independence begins with these words.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
The Declaration goes on to say,
we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
The British believed that the Americans were violating British law. Jefferson argued that the British treatment of the American colonies violated the natural laws of God. This idea of natural law had been expressed by British and French philosophers more than 100 years earlier. Jefferson had studied these philosophers in school, but in writing the Declaration of Independence, he said the words came straight from his heart. The Declaration goes on to list 27 complaints against the king. There are complaints against taxes without the consent of the colonists and against the presence of British troops in the colonies. After the list, Jefferson went on to write this statement.
That these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And that as free and independent states, they have the full power to levy war, conduct peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Jefferson concluded the Declaration with a line that was meant to persuade the delegates to support the most serious step, revolution.
And for the support of this Declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.